didn't even pretend to run the prison by R.E.A. Coopersmith. My great-grandfather Shmuel was maybe 14 years old when the Kaiser's men grabbed him out of a Jewish village in Eastern Europe and dropped him into a war with the Italians. He was a scholar, not a soldier. He knew the Talmud and the Torah, the prayers and the rituals. Nothing about guns or battles. So of course they put him in charge of a prison full of Italian prisoners of war. Here's what he did. He gathered all the prisoners together and told them the truth. I can't run this prison. I want you to run it. I'll stand out front so it looks like I'm in charge, but you take care of it. Keep things clean, get the meals served on time, and don't try to escape, because those men out there with guns are just waiting for you. And they agreed. He sat in the corner with his sacred books, studying, while the prisoners ran the prisons. Years later, a woman named Sophia listened to me tell that story and pointed out something I'd never quite seen. He didn't even pretend to run it, she said. He just opened it up to other people and other possibilities. And she wondered aloud whether maybe I was his great-grandson after all. I've been thinking about that ever since, because when I look at the whole long arc of my life, the hitchhiking, the house of love and prayer, the corporate sales, the marriages, the community I'm building now, that's the thread. Getting different people into the same room with different backgrounds and different views and finding what holds them together. I didn't always know how. Like Shmuel, I mostly just stopped pretending I was the one in charge. The echo chamber. I grew up in Leonia, New Jersey, a conservative, white Protestant town, birthplace of the Daughters of the American Revolution. My father was a Republican of the old kind. Keep the government out of business, work hard, play by the rules, get rich. In 1952, I was firmly with the We Like Ike crowd. Then, in high school, my best friend became Tony Fletcher. His father was the editor of the Daily Worker, the communist newspaper. My father forbade me to go to their house. We don't want those evil communists getting their hands on you.
There was a lot of paranoia in those days. But Tony and I figured that if a communist and a Republican could be friends, then maybe anybody could be friends. So we started something we called the group. Anybody could say what they thought, as long as they respected everyone else. We published a little newspaper called The Echo Chamber. The principal threatened to throw us out of school. A few of our parents were on the school board, so we asked them to cover us, and then I walked into the principal's office, laid the next edition on his desk, said hi, and walked out. I didn't realize it at the time, but that became a direction in my whole life. I love to get people together who see the world differently and find a way for them to talk and learn from each other. I was always the one placed in the other category. At Wesleyan, I was the token Jew, so they roomed me with the token black student, Tunde Ojo from Nigeria. Everyone else got invited into a frat house except the two of us, so we hung out together, and I learned about Africa and a great deal more. Later, needing cheap rent, I lived in the Fillmore District in San Francisco, sometimes the only white guy on the block. What I learned to do, without ever thinking about it, was a kind of shape-shifting, being appropriate to whatever room I was in, belonging to it. I picked it up unconsciously. It shaped how I saw everyone. My thumb at the turnpike. When I sat in on top of the nuclear submarines with a non-violence group, my conservative father, who believed we had to defend America with strong arms, cut off my money. One thing led to another, and I ended up standing at the entrance to the New Jersey Turnpike, with my clothes in a backpack, all by myself, my thumb stuck out, headed west. Somebody once asked me what guided me each time I stood at a crossroads like that, wondering what came next. The honest answer is that the guidance always showed up in a place I wasn't expecting. I didn't know I'd end up in San Francisco. I was just trying to read the signals around me and stay open to where they were taking me. In Iowa, some farm boys picked me up, drove me to a cornfield, and showed me the marijuana growing between the rows. "You look like the type who might be interested," they said. I emptied my backpack of all my clothes, filled it with marijuana, and figured that was all I needed. A week later, I was riding across the Bay Bridge into San Francisco, looking around, thinking, "I'm not in Jersey anymore. It can be anybody." One day at San Francisco State, on my way to class, I saw a man on a stage with a guitar. A rabbi with a beard. The singing rabbi, someone told me. I'd heard of the singing nun, never a singing rabbi. Everybody was dancing, so danced. Eventually, hundreds of us stood in a great circle with our arms around each other, and I noticed something strange. I couldn't tell where my arm ended and the next person's shoulder began. It felt like we were all one big being.
That rabbi, Shlomo Carlebach, became my teacher. During the summer of love in 1967, walking down Haight Street, he came up with the idea to start a house where anyone in the world who was looking for the great day of love and peace would be welcome. I asked him, Shlomo, do they have to be Jews? He said, no, it can be anybody. If he had said it had to be Jews, all the Jews would not have come, but he said it can be anybody. Shlomo wasn't the type to make things happen. He was the type to sing songs. My friend John Seaman, who was studying to be a Presbyterian minister, told me, maybe it's not Shlomo's job to start this house. Maybe it's your job. I said, how? I don't have any money. He handed me his entire life savings, $400, and told me his parents had already taken care of him. So I walked into the first realtor I saw, got into his Cadillac, and rented a beautiful house on Arguello Boulevard for $300 a month, plus a $100 deposit. Exactly $400. Within a few weeks, people were pouring in from every direction, sleeping in the basement, the living room, everywhere. That was the house of love and prayer. Getting the right people in the room. Years later, after my first marriage ended and I had a family to support on a community college instructor's salary, which even then was impossible, I walked into an interview for a sales job at Exxon Office Systems. The woman interviewing me, Diane, God bless her, looked at my resume and asked if I'd ever been in sales. No, ever worked with technology. No, ever worked for a corporation at all. No. So why should I hire you? I reached into my wallet and pulled out a picture of my little daughter Noe, a couple of years old. When I was growing up, I told her, my dad worked hard so I could have every opportunity. I want to do the same for her. She looked at the picture, looked back up, and said, okay, you're hired. I didn't know anything about word processors or fax machines or, later, mainframe computers. What I knew was how to get the right people in the same room at the same time. The word processing department full of women, the legal department full of men, the sales and technology groups, and help them solve a problem together as a system. I became the number one sales representative on the West Coast and made more money than I ever thought I could. My mother asked me on the phone what I was doing for a living. I explained it. She said, so when are you going to get a real job? That system's way of seeing came from an unlikely place, studying humanistic psychology and family therapy at Sonoma State. Family therapy taught me not to look at the troubled person as an individual, but as the identified symptom of a system that isn't working. It's the difference between saying we've got a bad president, it's all his fault, and saying the president is a symptom of a broken system. That's the whole difference in how I came to see almost everything. Laughing lessons. When my second marriage was falling apart, the kids were splitting each week between their mother and me. My daughter was about 12, my son about 7.
And I was trying to hold down a sales
job, pick them up from school, make dinner, get the homework done, the baths done. One night at dinner, I was rushing them. Come on, hurry up. And my daughter looked at me and said, Dad, you need laughing lessons. Then the two of them started clowning, jumping on the table, doing the most ridiculous things, until I couldn't help myself and started laughing. They became two of my biggest teachers about how to shift gears, how to be in the present, how to accept the moment I'm actually in. I really love marriage, but I don't love it enough to want to do another one, so I'm sticking with this one. Wendy and I have been together 25 years now, and we're doing a pretty good job. Today is a gift. These days, I run something called One World Lights, a community of people all over the world who want to bring a little more kindness and generosity into things and help each other organize to do it. This morning, I sat in a conversation with someone from Nigeria, someone from the Ivory Coast, someone from Kenya, all of us asking what's happening in our communities and how we can hold each other up. It's the same circle I've been trying to make my whole life, just wider now. Someone recently asked what I know now that I wish I'd known when I was young. For years, when somebody made noise that irritated me, my instinct was outrage. How dare they behave that way? What I've learned later is simpler. That's them. I can observe it. I'm still me. It doesn't change me. If I'd known that earlier, I might have been spared a few divorces. Then again, my son and daughter might not exist. So there's a reason for everything. My great-grandfather didn't know how to run a prison, so he did what he came to. He opened it up and trusted the people in front of him. Maybe that really does make me his great-grandson. The one thing I would tell my younger self, standing at that turnpike with his thumb out, not knowing a thing about where he was going, is this. Today is a gift, and your only job is to really, really accept it.